Thank you. Okay, so I'll start by giving you the motivation to measure supermassive black holes' masses in active galactic nuclei. And of course, the first one is quite obvious. It is just by knowing the masses that we can ever hope to learn something about the mechanisms of formation and evolution of different types of AGNs. For instance, in the past couple of years, or 1 year or so, there has been quite heated debate about the nature of narrow-line super wan galaxies. This is a plot taken from a recent paper by Amory Vandal, where the mass of supermassive black hole is compared to the luminosity of the host bulge for different types of AGNs. Narrow-line super wan galaxies are shown as the red dots here. Regular, quote-unquote, super wan galaxies and quasars as the remaining points. And as you can see from this figure here, narrow-line super wan galaxies seem to have lower black hole masses compared to their bulge luminosities than do regular super wan galaxies or quasars. And Vandal and other people, for example, Smith and Mature at Ohio State and her collaborators, interpret this kind of evidence as meaning that narrow-line super wan galaxies are at a very early stage of their AGN evolution. So they still have very small black holes accreting at very close to the Eddington limit, and given enough time, where that is a few times 10 to the 8 years or so, they will be moving up in this diagram and join the place which is occupied by the other AGNs. This is a different example, and I won't really go into the details of this, but it's from a recent paper by Barrison et al., where in the space which is defined by the accretion rate and the ratio of the Eddington luminosity at which these objects are radiating, different types of AGNs, and you can see here narrow-line super wan galaxy radio quiet and radio light quasar, broad absorption line quasars, they do occupy different regions in this diagram. Lines of constant supermassive black hole masses are diagonal here. So you can see how knowing the masses is actually very important to be able to distinguish between these different types of AGNs and also to try to derive what drives their evolution and their formation. There is a second motivation to look for supermassive black hole masses in AGNs, which is somewhat less obvious. And that is shown here. This is the correlation between black hole masses and the velocity dispersion of the host bulge, and I won't go into any detail of this because I think we'll hear about it in the next talk. But this is just to show that this is mainly defined by quiescent galaxies. With spatially resolved kinematics, there is one necessary condition that you need to meet, which is you need to resolve the sphere of influence of the black hole, the region of space within which the black hole gravitational potential dominates over the gravitational potential of the surrounding stars. Now, at the distance of M31, this line here divides the region of space in which the black hole sphere of influence is unresolved and the one in which it is resolved. So at the distance of M31, only black holes of the order of a few times 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 can be resolved, can be measured using spatially resolved kinematics. If you move a Virgo, of course, your mass limit will increase. So a Virgo only black holes larger than 10 to the 7 or so will be resolved, and then, therefore, they can be measured. The method that we have at our disposal to measure supermassive black hole masses in AGNs are, in principle, insensitive to the mass of the black hole or the distance of the galaxy, and therefore, you can, with those methods, try to fill in this region of space, which is critical for models of formation and evolution of supermassive black hole, and that will not be addressed using spatially resolved gas kinematics. So what are those methods? Before going into the details, I would like to point out that actually about half of the galaxies for which a black hole has been measured using resolved gas dynamics, in fact all of them, are very low luminosity AGNs. So there is a list here. So galaxies, for example, thanks. Like M87 and GSU-4261, which is shown here, are all low luminosity AGNs, aligners or radio galaxies. And the most famous, so to speak, AGN or galaxy for which a supermassive black hole has been measured is NGC-4258. These are BLBA observations, and that galaxy is a CIFR-2 galaxy. Now, for the rest of the talk, I will have a concentrate on the higher luminosity AGNs of Cypher 1 galaxies and quasars. And for these kind of objects, there really is only one method that you can apply to try to measure the masses of supermassive black holes, and that is reverberation mapping. Now, this is an oversimplification of what the method entails, but it's just to give an idea. This is, of course, a schematic of the very innermost region of an AGN. Now, in the type 1... In the type 1 AGNs, for which we have an undisturbed view of the central engine and the central broadline region, the responsivity-weighted radius of the broadline region can be measured from the time travel delay response between continuum and emission variations. Once you do that, which is non-trivial, if you have one extra if you make one extra assumption, which is if the velocity of the broadline region is gravitationally dominated, so if those broadline clouds move under the gravitational potential of the black hole, then knowing the radius and the velocity, which you can easily measure from the width of the emission lines, then you know the mass simply from the virial theorem. Now, this last hypothesis has actually received fairly strong observational support in a number of cases. This is a figure taken from a recent paper by Peterson and Vandal. So these are three, or better, two Cypher 1 galaxy and one quasar. This is the full width of maximum of different emission lines plotted against the time delay between emission and continuum variation for each of those emission lines. And as you can see, let's see which one is it, the solid line here is just a Keplerian relation, so it has a slope of 2. The dotted line is the best fit, and in every case the best fit is consistent with the Keplerian relation. So this is strong support for the fact that, the region is in fact gravitationally supported. This is the same idea for a different galaxy in a paper that appeared on AstroPH just a couple of days ago. So this is a very simplified view, if you like, of the broadline region, just simply a broadline region which is photoionized and is stratified. Now, there are, to this date, about 36 galaxies for which reverberation mapping studies have been done. The black hole masses go from 10 to the 6 to about a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses. The region of space which is targeted is, of course, tiny, between 1 and 400 light days. And this really is the main strength of reverberation mapping. You are so close to the central engine that you're really very insensitive to anything else but the gravitational potential of the black hole. And again, this is somewhat in contrast with studies of resolved gas or stellar kinematics, where the black hole really has a small effect on the kinematics that you observe. Of course, the drawbacks of reverberation mapping is that it can only be applied to the 1% of galaxies that have a type 1 AGNs. And the main problem is that, of course, the method is really ridden by a series of systematic effects that are very hard to quantify. For instance, as I said, the velocity structure of the broadline region seems to be Keplerian, but that's not an airtight conclusion. We don't know what the geometry of the broadline region is. We don't know if it is spherical or flattened. We don't know what the emissivity function of the gas is. We don't know where the central continuum source is located. We don't know the extent of that source. So there's a series of assumptions that any one of them could, if assumed incorrectly, could create errors in the masses of a factor of a few. In other words, the method has to be tested against something else in order for us to have any confidence in it. And finally, it's of course observationally very challenging, because what you need to do is take an AGN and then have very frequent monitoring over very long time scales. So you need almost unlimited access to not a necessarily big telescope, but you need to be able to have access for weeks or months at a time. Now, this last problem can somewhat be overcome if you use methods which in analogy with the distance scale business, I call secondary mass estimators, because they really are based on reverberation mapping. They are calibrated on reverberation mapping. And they're based on correlations between the size of the Brownian region and other properties of the host galaxies. The one which is most often used is this one. This is a correlation between, as I said, the size of the Brownian region, which is measured using reverberation mapping, and the monochromatic luminosity at 5100 angstroms. Now you can see that there certainly is a correlation. As a matter of fact, you expect the correlation to have a slope of 0.5, which is shown by this dashed line here, if the Brownian region is photoionized and the ionization parameter is constant with luminosity. The actual fit is a little bit steeper, is about has a slope of about 0.7 or so. But as you can see, I mean, the data is fairly red, especially at the very low and very high ranges for that radius R. Nevertheless, if you do believe the correlation, all you need to do is one single measurement, 5100 angstrom. You can just read the radius off the chart and measure the mass that way. A second method is the so-called photoionization method, and this just relies on the fact that the photoionization parameter, or better, its product with the electron density, is simply proportional to the inverse square of the radius of the Brownian region. Now, if you assume that that photoionization parameter is universal, which is probably not true, then you can derive that radius if you know what the ionization luminosity is, and that you can know if you have a complete SED for that particular galaxy you're studying. Now, this paper, this plot is from a paper by Vandal, Peterson, and Malkin just a few years ago, where they compare the reverberation mapping masses with photoionization masses, and they do find that there is indeed a fairly reasonable correlation. So even if this method and the previous one can give you masses which are off by a factor of several for individual galaxies, in a statistical sense, for a large sample, they actually work fairly well. And in fact, historically, this particular method was the one that was applied over 10 years ago now for the very first, and to my knowledge, only study of black hole demographics in AGNs. And the upshot of that study, which was, I think, very influential, was the following. That study was done by Padovani in 1990. It was actually Padovani, Berg, and Edelson. What they found is that the cumulative mass density in supermassive black holes in CIFR-1 galaxies, which you see here plotted as a function of black hole mass, is of the order of a few thousand solar masses per megaparsec cube. And this is very different from the result that you obtained from optical quasar counts from the luminosity function of quasars. That cumulative mass density, which is shown by the blue lines there, is several tens to about two orders of magnitude larger. And this study really spurred the interest in supermassive black holes in quiescent galaxies, because what this is telling us is that local CIFR-1 galaxies or local AGNs are not the only repository of the black holes that used to power high redshift quasars. So a large number of those black holes must be residing in galaxies which are now quiescent. I think Carl, in the next talk, will tell us that that is in fact the case. Okay, so there has been a lot of dispute and a lot of disagreement in the past couple of years or so regarding the comparison between the masses of supermassive black holes in AGNs and in quiescent galaxies. So let me just review what the arguments for that statement are. Okay, so until a couple of years ago, and again, I won't go into detail of this because this is really Carl's territory, but the only method we have to look for black hole demographics in quiescent galaxies was this plot, which shows black hole masses as a function of the blue luminosity of the host galaxy. This is a plot from a paper by Magari et al. And this gives a ratio between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the host bulge of about 0.6% in quiescent galaxies. This is exactly the same plot, but now using reverberation masses for CIFR-1 galaxies and quasars. That gives, so this the best fit to this data here is shown by that, and the CIFR-1 galaxy lie definitely below that line, giving a ratio between black hole mass and bulge mass of only about 0.03%. Now, we actually know that, we think we understand at least now where that difference was coming from. It was actually, the blame has to be shared between the two studies, but part of the problem is that we now believe that the masses which were derived by that study by Magorian et al. Are actually overestimated by a factor of a few to even 100 in some particular case. So this value has now come down using updated masses to about 0.15%. On the other hand, Vandal was using very inaccurate estimates of the blue luminosity of the host bulge, overestimating it by about, in some cases, even 3 magnitudes. This is very hard because these are super 1 galaxies with a very bright nucleus. So this number has now come up by a factor of about 10 to 0.2%. So now the two numbers seem to agree reasonably well. However, even within the AGN community, there has been disagreement about what that number in particular is. And here is a very quick run through of what the situation was about a year ago. The first study was done by Lauer in 1998. Lauer used that correlation that I showed before between the sizes of, or the radius of the broad line region and the monochromatic luminosity 5100 angstroms. So he derived black hole masses that way for a sample of Cipher 1 galaxies and quasar, which are shown here. He then used bulge disk decomposition to derive the luminosity of the host bulges, and he found that the ratio between masses of the black hole and the bulge is about 0.6%. The study of Vandal that I just showed used better masses, reverberation mapping masses, but used a very inaccurate estimate of the bulges, which is just derived from this empirical formula, which has a huge scatter, and they found a much lower value. And then finally, McClure and Dunlop sort of split the difference between the two. They found a value of 0.25%, but very, very different assumption. In both of these two cases, the broad line region is assumed to be spherical and with an isotropic velocity distribution. In this, so the velocity is related to the full width of maximum of the line that you're looking at as the square root of 3 divided by 2. On the other hand, McClure and Dunlop assume the flattened geometry, so a very different correlation between the observed full width of maximum and the velocity of the broad line region. They also assume a value of the Hubble constant of about 50, and I'm not really sure why people don't really pay attention to the Hubble constant, but it is in fact important. So if you take all of these data and actually use a consistent set of assumptions, and I'm not saying the right set of assumptions, but a consistent one, you find that there is no discrepancy whatsoever between all of these studies. This is a very confused plot. I apologize for that, but anyway, this is black hole mass against the blue luminosity bulge again. The little black dots are quiescent galaxies. The triangles are the Cipher ones, and the circles are the quasars. Now, as you can see, the scatter is very large. These lines are lines of constant ratio between black hole mass and the mass of the bulge. So in spite of the very large scatter, as you can see, all three types of galaxy populations in here give a very consistent ratio between black hole masses and the mass of the bulge, which is of the order of about 0.2%. I should also point out that these arrows show where the points would move if you make a different assumption. So I use a spherical broad line region here. If you assume a flattened geometry like McClure and Dunlop do, they all move up by that amount. If you use a Hubble constant of 50, black hole masses don't change, but the luminosity does. So everything moves by that amount. So it's actually a very big effect. Okay, I should also point out that the size of these points here is proportional to the full width F maximum of the H beta line. So narrow line Cipher 1 galaxies are the one with the smallest symbols here. And as you can see, there might be some indication that black hole masses are smaller in the objects with a narrower permitted lines. However, it certainly is not terribly obvious from this diagram. The problem is that the scatter, even for the quiescent galaxy, is very large in this particular diagram. So it became very obvious when the M-sigma relation was discovered that was really the way to go to actually measure to compare the masses in AGN, sequoias, and galaxies. Now, this is, of course, complicated because this is, for example, a typical C41 galaxy, but it's a very famous one. And you can see how the C41 nucleus in there is really overwhelming the light from the bulge. So actually measuring the velocity dispersion of the bulge in these galaxies is not a trivial task. There are values which are published in the literature, mainly by this study from Nelson and Whittle in 1995. They're not very accurate, however, they have errors which are in general 30% or sometimes much larger. Carl Gebhardt and his collaborators, using those published values, were the first to show that the quiescent galaxies here, this is again mass of the black hole against velocity dispersion of the bulge. The quiescent galaxies, shown as the open circles, and the reverberation map galaxies really seem to follow pretty much the same M sigma relation. But as I said, the errors on these these velocity dispersions are very large. For some of these galaxies, a factor of a few. So it was this really brought everybody's hopes up. So what we did was start a program with a 4-meter key peak and with Gemini for the most distant objects to actually go and measure very accurately what the velocity dispersions of the bulges for all of these reverberation mapped galaxies are. We now have about maybe 20 galaxies or so, but I'm really confident about 10 of them. So those are the ones that are plotted here. Again, the solid dots are the quiescent galaxies, while the red triangles here are the reverberation mapped galaxies. So these are examples of the spectra that we have to deal with. So there are a couple of conclusions that can be drawn from this particular plot. First of all, it certainly does not seem to be the case, as Vandel was claiming only about a couple of years ago, that black hole masses using reverberation mapping are underestimated compared to the masses that we find in quiescent galaxies. However, the scatter for the reverberation mapped galaxies seem to be larger, maybe a factor of two or so, compared to the scatter that we observe for the quiescent galaxies. At any rate, given the present sample, the fit to the reverberation map galaxy is exactly consistent to the fit that we get from just the quiescent galaxies. There are three narrow-line C41 galaxies in this plot, which are shown by these blue triangles here. And three galaxies is not a very big sample. On the other hand, given these three, there is not an overwhelming, but there is no indication that their masses are in fact underestimated with respect to the masses in a regular C41 galaxy. Okay, so given that I think I have still about 10 minutes or so, if you allow me, I would just like to switch gears completely for a few minutes before then coming back to AGN, so just bear with me for just a second or so. So I just wanted to give you a preview and maybe get some impressions from the people in the audience about some work that I've done very recently. The motivation for this work is the following. I think we'll hear about the M-sigma relation in the next talk, but the M-sigma relation is telling us is that there is a correlation between the masses of supermassive black holes and the masses of the host bulges. However, most self-regulating models for the formation of supermassive black holes really predict a correlation between the black hole masses and the total gravitational mass of the galaxy or the mass of the dark matter halo in which these black holes are originally formed. So the idea here is to see whether the M-sigma relation is really the fundamental reflection of the modality of black hole formation or whether there is something even more fundamental which is reflected in a correlation between the black hole masses and the masses of the dark matter halos. Of course, the latter are not very easy to measure. In fact, I don't believe it has been done for any galaxies in particular. On the other hand, just as the black hole mass is directly related to the velocity dispersion of the bulge, the mass of the halo is directly related to the circular or the virial velocity of, for example, in spiral galaxy, the H1 disks. So if you take a sample of galaxies, this is a typical rotation curve for a spiral galaxy. So very steep increase, of course, in the center, which is bulge dominated, and then in the outer part, you have a very flat rotation curve. This line here shows the optical radius of the galaxy. So, of course, the fact that rotation curves are flat beyond the optical radius has been interpreted since the work of Vera Rubin in the early 80s as evidence for the fact that there is a significant dark matter component in all of these galaxies. In elliptical galaxies, it's a little bit more complicated. However, Kronawitter et al. And Gerard, just in the past couple of years, have been able to derive rotation curves for example about 20 galaxies, and this is done by using dynamical models, applying dynamical models to the observed velocity dispersion and line profiles and brightness profiles. The upshot of this particular study is that elliptical galaxies seem to show a dynamical homology. So you take a rotation curve of one and then you scale it, and you can match exactly the rotation curve of everything else at any other luminosity. The other result is that all of the rotation curves for the elliptical seem to be flat, just as is the case for the spirals outside about 0.3 effective radii. So now the idea here is to plot the circular velocity, which, as I said, is a measure of the mass of the dark matter halo, or the total gravitational mass within that radius, against the black hole mass or the velocity dispersion of the bulge. And this is what that correlation looks like. So again, the velocity dispersion of the bulge is measured within a radius of about 0.5 kiloparsec or so. So in the very innermost region of the galaxy where the rotation curve is still very steeply rising. The circular velocity is measured at radii between 40, 60, 80 in some cases, kiloparsecs, so very far out where the rotation curve, of course, is already flat. The open circles are the ellipticals, the closed circles are the spirals. So I was actually very surprised by the fact that the elliptical sample and the spiral sample seem to merge so nicely in this diagram. A linear correlation for the actual ellipticals is not at all surprising, but it's just a byproduct of the dynamical models that were applied, because they imply dynamical homology. So you expect to be able to exchange any velocity scale with any other velocity scale. However, the location of that sample in the vertical axis is not at all a given. So the fact that they do seem to blend perfectly well with the spiral is actually a surprise. This galaxy here is M33, so it's a clear outlier in this relation. If you exclude that galaxy, then you find that this is the best fit to the relation. It's clearly driven by these two galaxies here. If you exclude those two galaxies as well, so if you exclude, well, there is a reason for that, but if you exclude everything below about, 120 or so, the relation is actually a much better fit to the remaining sample. And it's consistent within the errors with the linear relation. Now, I think this per se is actually an interesting result, because within the error, what that plot is telling us is that the velocity dispersion of the bulge is comparable to the velocity dispersion of the halo, which I think is fairly surprising, because it's telling us something about the central potential. And in particular, it seems to me, it's telling us that the central potential is very close to being isothermal, which I think it's very surprising. In terms of black holes, of course, the velocity dispersion, the bulge velocity dispersion can be converted easily to a black hole mass. The circular velocity can be converted, well, I mean, if you just pick a radius in every galaxy where all of the rotation curves are flat, then that circular velocity through the Virial theorem is just proportional to the total mass within that radius. More interestingly though, that circular velocity is a measure of the virial velocity of the halo. Okay, how you actually connect the two is a little bit, the amount of hand waving here is increasing steadily, but it's a little bit tricky. But if you use, for example, an NFW profile, then you can find a formulation to relate one to the other. So once you do that, you can translate that correlation that I just showed to a correlation between black hole masses and the masses of the dark matter halo. So this is exactly the same plot that I showed before with a change of coordinates, basically. This Duffy relation here is a linear relation. This is actually the best fit, which is shown here. So the best fit is definitely nonlinear, which means that as you go to lower and lower masses for the dark matter halos, you are becoming less and less efficient in forming the supermassive black hole at the center. So for halos of the order of 10 to the 14th solar masses or so, you have that the ratio between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the halo is of the order of 6 × 10⁻-5. But when you go to very much smaller halos, let's say 10 to the 12 solar masses, that ratio is only about 10⁻². And then something happens. Again, this galaxy is M33, and I think, again, Carl will probably mention this. This galaxy has an upper limit of 1,000 or so, 2,000. On the mass of the central black hole. So there is no way to reconcile this galaxy with this relation. And again, for these two galaxies here, it's very hard to reconcile them. I should point out that the M-sigma relation, which I used to get black hole masses in this axis, is actually not defined at all below 10 to the 6 solar masses. So this is a little bit of an extrapolation. However, to bring these masses down onto that relation, you would need a kink in the M-sigma relation. You would need the M-sigma relation to predict larger black hole masses than the extrapolation from the larger masses, which is certainly not the case given this upper limit here. So my naive, maybe, interpretation of this is that indeed below 10 to the 12 solar masses, you might be losing the ability of forming supermassive black holes, which is why studies about intermediate massive black holes will be very relevant for this particular topic. So now you might be wondering, what does this have to do with AGNs? It turns out it does. Because if you know the relation between the mass of black holes and the mass of dark matter halos, you can do a lot of fun things. For example, you can take the luminosity function of quasars, and you can see whether you can match that if you just assume a mass function from some CDM cosmology for the dark matter halos. It turns out you can easily do, well, fairly easily do that, but you have one variable, which is the lifetime of each individual quasar. If the relation is nonlinear, if you increase this exponent here, what happens is that you are preferentially building more massive black holes associated with more massive quasars. So in effect, you are increasing the lifetime of each individual quasar. For an exponent of this type, the lifetime of the quasar would be of the order of the Salpeter time, so a few times 10 to the 7, which is in agreement with what we think that lifetime should be. If this relation were linear, you would expect very low lifetimes for quasars of the order of 10 to the 5 or so, which are completely inconsistent with what we think is going on. Okay, so I think I'm probably pretty much done, so I'll skip that one. And I guess I'll just let you read this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for keeping such tight time. Question? Yes, Matt.
I still have a very strong impression that there are some fairly well-conceived galaxies that are in very fine-tuned galaxies of course. Maybe not very hot. Mm-hmm.
You mean the mass for the bulge?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, there's not much of a galaxy at all.
Right. So what are you driving at? That you don't need the bulge for?
It wouldn't even make a black hole, but then it couldn't.
Oh, no. Right. I'm not sure that you would not make a black hole. All I'm saying is that, you know, it's fine. Okay, this is all based on three galaxies, okay? So there's not much that you can speculate. But so all I'm saying is that they might become less efficient in forming black holes. And I don't know about these dwarfs, what the estimates for the dark matter halos might be. But 10 to the 12 is pretty small. Yeah?
Chris, are there any liberation measurements for how long it will take to form a
small black hole? Right, no. So the ones that I... there are a few. Hello. Okay, and they are the ones that are shown here. There's a few more actually that we have not looked at yet, but these three are narrow lines for one galaxy. So for these three, it doesn't look like the masses are underestimated.
Can I follow up on that question, though? If you compare them to the luminosities, though, are they anomalously...
To the luminosities of the bulge? Or?
No, to the luminosities of the active nucleus itself. Are these closer to Eddington accretors than say, a typical...
No, right, no, they wouldn't be.
Okay.
So they would be below Eddington. So
okay.
They would, yeah. That's right.
If you take the circular velocity, mention the circular velocities of spirals without noticeable bulges, do you predict black hole masses that we should see?
Well, these ones, hold on, sorry. Okay, so these galaxies here, they're actually late-type spirals. All of these are like, these are SAs, but these are SCs or SDs where you can barely see the bulge. Now, 10 to the 6 solar mass, as I said before, it's hard to do using spatially resolved kinematics. But it's pretty much, I mean, it wouldn't be hard to do. There's just no galaxies where you can do it, with one exception. So the one exception is NGC 205, which is a companion of Andromeda, as you know. Which is based on the extrapolation of the M-sigma relation, should have a black hole mass of a few times 10 to the 4 solar masses, maybe 10 to the 5 solar masses. So it's the only galaxy for which a black hole below 10 to the 6 solar masses can be measured using the classical methods. And in fact, we have time with HST to do that in the upcoming year or so. But that really is the only one. So the hope really lies with reverberation mapping in that region.
Our galaxy is just
an outlier on this spot? No, our galaxy is this one. So it really doesn't seem to be. And in fact, there is a paper by Kleipin where they do measure the virial mass for the dark matter halo in the Milky Way, and they come out with a value about 10 to the 12, which, you know, is very consistent with what you derive from this. Arguments about the circular velocity. In fact, there are two galaxies here which have a measured black hole mass. Our galaxy, as you mentioned, is one of them, and the other one is NGC 4258, and they both lie right on the relation. There's also three ellipticals with a measured black hole mass.